Hello and welcome to the Business Podcast at Imperial College Business School. I am your host, Amin Siala, and today we've got a special episode where we're going to discuss everything to do with design thinking. With me today is Dr. Ileana Stiliani. She is an assistant professor of design and innovation at the Innovation and Entrepreneurship Department at Imperial College Business School. She received her PhD in management from Bocconi University in Milan. Her research focuses on how designers develop ideas that lead to successful new products and services. Her research has been published in top management journals such as Administrative Science Quarterly, the Academy of Management Journal, the Journal of Management, and various others. She's also given interviews on design thinking to various media outlets, including Financial Times, The Economist, BBC News, and The Guardian. She teaches the design thinking and design management modules to MBA and MSc students. And she was the first academic to teach design thinking at Imperial and created the courses based on her research about how designers work and develop innovations. She was also recently voted as amongst the top 40 business school professors in the world by Poets and Quants, a great achievement for herself and the whole business school. And in front of me here is Michael Healy, who's currently an MBA student. He's actually a biomedical engineer, and he's from Ireland, worked 9 years in research, design and development of medical devices, worked across Ireland, UK, US and Germany. And to my left is Catherine Pelican, full-time MBA student at Imperial. And before her MBA, she spent 6 years working as an actuarial project manager in an international insurance company. Catherine is from the US, but has lived and studied abroad in Rome and now in London. And I must say that you two are in a team that's recently won an IDEO award. And your team name was Red Hot Problem Solvers.
That's right, yeah.
That was a great start. Thanks all for coming.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So, Dr. Leanna, why don't we start simply? What is design thinking?
So, design thinking is a methodology or a process to solve problems that is mainly based on identifying and exploring opportunities to innovate. And it's fundamentally human-centered, which is different from being customer-centered, because it really puts at the heart of the problem-solving approach all the stakeholders involved and all the stakeholders that are somehow affected by the problem. And one of the main differences between design thinking and the traditional, more analytical problem-solving approach is that design thinking is really based on exploring the problem. So the problem is not taken for granted, but especially the qualitative research that is being conducted is aimed at really identifying the root causes of the problem, so that by identifying the real problem, you can then generate the right ideas and the right solutions to solve this problem. So it's fundamentally different from the traditional analytical, rational, linear problem-solving approach, also because it's very iterative.
What is the traditional method?
It's mostly based on, so I have a problem, I take it for granted, I generate a hypothesis based on assumptions, so based on the knowledge that I have or on the data that I have available, and then I go out and I test the hypothesis. There is a problem in there because, as I said, the problem might be the symptom of some root causes that we might not know. So if we are trying to solve a false problem, there is a risk that we are going to solve it in a wrong way, or we are generating solutions that actually don't bring any benefit for those who have problems, who are affected by a problem.
And you brought the design thinking, essentially you were the first to teach it at Imperial. And what is it that interests you in general about the concept compared to I guess, any other field of research?
Well, as I jokingly say to my students, I wanted to be a designer, but I grew up in a family of accountants. Okay, so I ended up to business school, but my passion for design was there. Right. So when I was doing my PhD, I decided to focus my research on understanding how creative workers, and in my case, designers, how do they develop ideas? What are the best practices? What are the processes, the tools and methods? With the idea of deciphering what they do and what they do very well, and to translate that into the business world, which is traditionally considered not creative, but actually it can be very innovative and very creative by somehow infusing the right methodology and the right mindset. So I have to say it's my passion and my mission. So it comes quite naturally to me.
I think so. I mean, it's the core of your research. I can't think of the word design thinking without thinking of Dr. Eliana at the present moment. So why don't we actually flesh this out for those that might have never come across the term design thinking, or even if they have, it would have been only briefly. So you've had the module, Michael and Catherine. Okay, I've had it as well in the MSc program, design thinking. And I guess maybe we've been exposed to it firsthand, where we've actually put it into practice.
Yeah.
So is there a way we can illustrate that potentially? Maybe we can hear it from you, Michael.
Yeah, of course.
What was your experience with design thinking? What is it?
Yeah, so for us, it started off, we formed a team and we had to decide on a problem that was relevant and had a social impact for us and people that we were aware of. And you know, that was probably one of the hardest parts, was to come up with a problem that we thought we could action. It was sort of somewhat realistic, and there was, you know, you could generate something at the end of it. So what we ended up dealing with, or the project we chose, was trying to help the elderly people and using how the world of technology is moving so fast, and some of the elderly people we felt in just being marginalized a little bit. A lot of banks are closing and only going online. A lot of shopping is done online now, and there's a lot of the population who aren't, you know, being captured with these innovations in technology. So we sat as a group and we sort of, that was our initial sort of thinking. Let's see what we can do to address the sort of needs of the elderly and the population and make sure they're not left behind. And that was sort of the problem statement we had. And from there, we sort of kept, you know, working on that, trying to find, as Anna said, the real root cause to that. Is it that the technology, the phones are too small? You know, that would be a real easy assumption to make. Just make a big iPad,
right.
Just make it easier to see. That would be really quickly, yeah, let's just do that and that would be it. But we, you know, we did spend probably six weeks going, looking at the problem statement, interviewing people. I know Catherine spent a lot of time at the What the Tech initiative, which is working with elderly people, to really challenge, you know, why are you not using technology as much as younger people?
Right.
What is the difficulty? And what can we do to help that? And then we'd come back with some ideas and then challenge them again and just iterate that way. So after about 6 weeks, we got to, you know, what we thought was a bit more of the root cause. And maybe Catherine can talk a little bit about What the Tech, because we got a lot of feedback from What the Tech.
Right. So we were actually really lucky, because the What the Tech program was starting up again right as we had started the design thinking module. And basically what it is it's a student-run volunteer organization where we go to an elderly community center and basically just help them with any and all technology issues that they're facing. So Ileana mentioned before that design thinking isn't so much about just the customer, it's about the human. And through that experience, we were able to have direct human contact with people who actually faced these issues every day. And that way we were able to really work with the problem, and you know, we'd work with the elderly, we'd come back, we'd make some assumptions, and then the next week we'd talk to them again and we'd say, oh, maybe this isn't really the root cause. So it was a very iterative and eye-opening process.
Yeah.
Just to add on that is the human-centric part. It wasn't just the elderly people we'd focus on,
right,
as well. It's the other people. So we gave the example of us maybe trying to talk to our grandparents or parents on FaceTime and trying to explain to them, this is the button you need to push this button. And we created personas, which is to step through each person's activity in the sort of the process.
Yep.
So let's say you want to call your relative in New Zealand, we used as an example.
Okay.
You know, how difficult is it for you as a, you know, as a young person, very fluent with technology,
right,
to explain to an elderly person? You know, how do your emotions change when you try and, you know, you get frustrated, you end up, you know, forget about it, we won't bother even trying to contact you anymore, because you're not following as well. So, and you know, not just the elderly, it's everybody in that, so like the stakeholders,
yeah,
so
everyone involved,
everybody involved. And we built different personas and thought, if we come up with a solution, does this help all the stakeholders?
Yeah,
so that was the kind of way we kind of,
so you said it's focusing on the problem statement to begin with, that's the core focus.
Yeah.
This is so one of the most illuminating things for me personally, when listening to the design thinking lessons, if you like, was a concept of focusing on the problem and not the solution.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as an engineer, that's not how I was taught to think. You know, mm-hmm. We always think, oh, you know, it's a solution. I need a cup that doesn't spill. I need a microphone that works.
Yeah.
I've got some technical problems.
Yeah.
That's how we led to think. But you know, Eliana kept shouting at us, saying, no,
yeah,
problem, I don't want to hear anything to do with a solution at all.
That wasn't just your class.
I was gently shouting.
Sure, yeah. No, don't think of the solution. I don't want to hear a prototype product. I don't want to hear it, just a problem. And so in our groups, actually, this is one of the things we kept raising in the meeting. I was like, do you know what? No, I want to give this a go. Let's actually give this a go. Let's forget about the solution. Let's just talk about the problem. Mm-hmm. And I think the difference is there is that sometimes the best solution to a problem might not be something that you'd think about, might not be something so obvious.
Yeah.
Exactly.
The example we have, so one of the problems that we wanted to focus on in our group was the problem with deliveries in busy cities. And, you know, if you're working or if you're at university and your parcel gets sent to your home and you're away, that gets sent back to the postal office and there's a miscommunication and it's delayed and all the rest of it. So the first proposed solution was to copy what was happening in Asia, which is where there's these lockers just scattered around the city. But then because we wanted to follow the concept of forgetting the solution, mm-hmm. when we actually just dug deep into that issue, we found that actually it's more of a communication issue between the humans, so it's human-centric, and how they receive the information with regards to the delivery. And it's just an entire different approach. So I don't know, do these examples, do you think that this is what design thinking is?
Absolutely. So the most challenging aspect of design thinking for people who have never been experienced to it is changing the mindset from I need a solution to we need to explore the problem and we need to really understand what the problem is. Mm. Because as I said previously, once you have identified the right problem, you can find the right solution. And I know that that's not the way we have been somehow educated. That's not the typical problem-solving approach. And I know that. And I usually go to lecture theaters and I on day one and I say, I know you're gonna hate me maybe, but I am offering you a different way to solve problems. Just give it a go. Just engage in the process with an open mind. And if you do that, the results will be positive. And I would say 98% of the time, students actually come back and say, I think you were right. Mm. And I mean, it's natural to have some skepticism at the beginning when something is completely new. And maybe, students are like, what does she really want us to do? I mean, this is sound really crazy. You know, she wants us to go out and to talk to people, to interview, to observe. Why can't we do a survey? Well, but then once you have done the qualitative research, you can appreciate how much more powerful it can be in identifying the root causes and the insights that will then guide the proper ideation, so the idea generation phase.
So who's the person implementing this at the moment? I mean, I mentioned earlier before the podcast that I've got a couple of friends in management consultancies that are telling me a lot of their clients are taking design thinking workshops. And they're really popular at this moment. So I'm just wondering, why is that the case?
So there has been a wave of acquisition by all the management, the big management consulting companies who have acquired design consulting firms because they have understood that there is value there. So design, the design process, can bring value not only for the end users of a certain product or service, but also, of course, for the providers of these products and services. So they definitely understood that there is value there, and they are offering, design thinking type of services to their clients. They are offering workshops. Something really important to say is that offering workshops is only the tip of the iceberg if you really want to change the mindset inside an organization.
Okay.
So if you really want to make a change, you have to change the culture of the organization. Examples in this respect are Pepsi. Pepsi is definitely transforming the entire organization around design thinking, and they are doing that not only by running workshops. With workshops, you can raise awareness, you can expose people to a methodology, but then to win them over, you have to change their mindset, you have to change their behaviors, you have to change deeper layers of the organization, and you can do that in different ways.
I mean,
So, Eliana, I'm probably going to go back to the insurance company that I worked for previously, and I had been thinking about, trying to implement this in my new team, but my first reaction was, I'll run a workshop. So how would you suggest that I bring this to an insurance company which isn't inherently that creative and change the culture.
A workshop is a good starting point. What you could do, for example, you can take a previous project that has been somehow worked on using traditional methodologies, and maybe it wasn't a success. Then you take that and you say, okay, let's try and solve this problem. Let's try and work on this project using this methodology, and let's see what we come up with, you know, at the end of it. And then you can use that, the outcome of that, which hopefully is going to be positive, to say, okay, this is what design thinking can do. I would be, if I were you, I would be ambitious. I would go straight to the top management. Because, I mean, organizational transformations, they have to start. They have to be championed by the top management. If you don't have the top management, then it's going to be difficult. Having said that, the transformation has to be cascaded through the organization, has to be somehow, people have to be brought on board. But you can do that by providing evidence of what design thinking can do. And again, a workshop is a good starting point, but you need more there.
It's just the starting point.
It's just the starting point, yes.
That's really interesting. Michael, you're from the medical devices kind of industry.
That's right, yeah.
And part of it is you're saying you research and design these, so I guess that there is possibly an obvious implementation here.
Yeah, there is, and I'm sort of fortunate. I had a previous manager who was very familiar with IDEO, and he's worked a little bit with them in California. So he was trying to instill this to some of our teams, and so I maybe had a bit of a head start over some of the colleagues in class and knew a little bit of the way this was going to go. So it is something I've used before in industry, and it's just more the mindset that, okay, let's say something breaks on your device. Don't just assume it's the first thing that breaks. Let's just look at everything that's there. Let's look at the whole chain of parts. Let's see where could this possibly have gone wrong before, and what can we do to prevent this happening in the future? So it's root cause analysis, similar to, as Ileana said, is, you know, in engineering terms, you might use 5 whys, and you might use different fishbone diagrams. But at the end of the day, it's still just a widespread investigation to really find the root cause. And if you're dealing with people, it's the same thing. Let's just talk to everybody and everybody, all the stakeholders.
Yeah.
Or if you're dealing with a product, is to look at every possible way that this can, you know, break or fail.
One thing with design thinking that I found was the degree of empathy you had to apply to it. Because just the process, if you looked at it, would look kind of like a scientific method. You know, you come up with a hypothesis, you test, you prototype. But you really have to bring such a great amount of empathy to the problem. I remember talking to my mother about one of the elderly women I was working with, and I told her, yeah, Cynthia said I was so patient, and she thanked me, and she said, I wish you could show that patience with me when I'm trying, you know, and it's like, wow, this is pretty humbling. Like, the human focus to it is really profound.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the aspects that allowed you to win the award. Because not only they really put themselves in the shoes of the elderly. I mean, that transpired in the final presentation. So the level of empathy and the emotional engagement that you created was mind-blowing. So and that's the way it's supposed to be, because, you know.
Okay, that's a really interesting point.
Yeah.
Because I'm interested in hearing your perspectives on how you can measure the success of design thinking,
mm-hmm.
right? And again, I know it's a very broad statement to make, but obviously you've seen multiple teams now. You've asked them to carry out design thinking approach. So how do you sit back and determine and grade them, in a sense? What metrics will you use? Is empathy one of the top metrics here?
So for me, the most important thing is how much they have engaged in the process. So the final solution might not be the perfect one, and I know I don't expect them to come up with a perfect solution, but I want to see how seriously and how committed they were in applying the process. And of course, you know, empathizing with the different people that are affected by a problem is the first and foremost criterion that I take into consideration. But also, I think more than the outcome is about how much they engage in the process. I have never given a bad mark to people who have engaged very seriously. They have been very committed and very dedicated, although maybe the final solution needed some more work and more development. The people usually get not a bad mark, but not a very positive one. It's people who actually don't listen to me, and they they basically apply the traditional problem solving approach. And I'm like, well, there's nothing that I can do here.
I think that was the difficulty. A lot of people very quickly found the problem and then assumed they knew the solution, and that's they never really let go with that.
And I'm guessing this is why you said that organizations need to embrace this fully and not just through a workshop.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. It has to be ingrained in the fabrics of the organization, and that can be done by changing the behaviors, by changing also, I keep saying the KPIs, the incentive systems have to change. So one of the aspects of design thinking is fail early to succeed sooner, right? Mm. So it's the idea of failing as a learning opportunity. So you develop an idea, you prototype it very rapidly in a very simple way, and then you test it in order to validate it. It might be wrong, it might be right, it might need further development, but that's a learning opportunity. Okay? Mm. Implementing that into organizations where the KPIs don't give people to the possibility to experiment, because you are punished if the first goal is not the right one.
Oh, okay.
So of course you're not creating the ground for design thinking to be really implemented. Mm. So the priorities have to change, and that can be done if the top management is definitely on board. But in order to align people to engage in these new behaviors, you have to change the KPIs. You have to somehow incentivize them and reward them for using design thinking. If I may go back to the idea of measuring design thinking, of course, there's no such thing as the return on investment. And actually, when leaders in organizations understand that they cannot measure a return on investment, that's when they have really understood the power of design thinking. Because, of course, there are things that you can measure and things that you can count. Complaints. If complaints,
decrease,
it means that you're doing a good job. That's something you can count and you can measure. But then there's other more qualitative and nuanced things, like a change in the language that people use. When people say, oh, we need to empathize with our customers, that's already a big signal that they... Okay. And then there's a change in the... in the language, in the conversations, then a change in the behavior. So it's not just... They don't just talk, but they walk the talk. So they go out and they observe people. And then there's a change in the mindset. So the moment that people say, okay, this was a failure, but what can we learn from it? That's the moment when the mindset has changed.
Okay, so you're kind of referring to the culture there.
The culture, the
thing that comes to mind there, so I had Basil Kusa, the founder of QuickUp, here on the podcast a couple of episodes ago, and he mentioned that what they do is they do delivery.
Mm-hmm.
You can order anything online. A last mile delivery is what they do. And he gets not everyone, but a lot of his employees that are actually based in the office to actually deliver. And the idea is that they get the first-hand experience of A, what the driver goes through, and B, just the whole experience. That way, even though the person might be an accountant, might be a PA, just doing an office job,
absolutely,
they're getting engaged, understanding the whole picture. Is this part of the culture?
Okay. Absolutely, yes, absolutely. So Deutsche Bank, for example, they have embraced design thinking. What they do is they ask their employees to experience their own services. So you have to put yourself in the shoes of your clients in order to really understand what their pain points are, what their expectations are. It's easy and it's very comfortable to sit at your desk and to assume things.
Mm.
And sometimes business leaders, they think they know. Oh, we know what our customers want. We know what our customers need. And then often you're like, well, but actually, if you actually listen to them, they might say things that you had never thought about. So the power, I cannot emphasize enough the power of qualitative research, the power of the voice of...
I'm going to throw in a curveball here.
Yeah, go ahead.
When people say that people don't know what they want, what's your response to that? What if to say, you can talk to 100 people, but ultimately, if you actually bring them something radical, they might all love it. So how does that fit in?
That's absolutely true. And I usually say to my students, it's not about asking people what they want, because sometimes they don't even know. It's about asking what's important for them. If you understand what motivates their behaviors, what determines their expectations. You might understand what drives human behavior. So why is Apple so successful? Because they have understood what drives human behavior. They have not asked people, do you want an iPhone or do you want an iPod? They have created these and they have shaped the way we act.
Okay.
In terms of changing mindsets, I think one thing that I found most difficult when going through design thinking was because we had to stick with the problem for so long, we found so many different intricacies just in the umbrella problem.
Yeah.
And I find that, do people find that the struggle, like, because you have to struggle really for a long time in order to find a solution that could possibly, and in our society now, it feels like it's just easier to find a Band-Aid or to you know, oh, that's the solution. So is there a way to get people to be comfortable with sticking with the problem and struggling for a long amount of time?
I think it's about asking yourself, okay, I'm struggling now, but then that means that the final outcome will probably be much more impactful than a Band-Aid. So the question is, do I want to come up with something which is meaningful, which is going to make an impact, commercial impact, social impact, or do I just want to have a Band-Aid? That is why I am so strict in, I call it the app trap. Right?
Yeah.
Because now, the app trap. So the first thing is that, oh, we have a problem. We have the solution. It's an app. And I'm like, well, maybe yes, but maybe not. And then, yes, you can have an app, but what's the idea behind the app? Because the app is only the means for you to deliver a certain idea, but what's the idea behind and how does this idea solve a problem? What benefits? So often students come to me and say, oh, I have an idea. Can I talk about the idea? I'm like, yeah, it's an app. And I'm like, no. Let's start over. So what is the real idea there?
Yeah.
And what is the problem that you're solving?
Yeah.
Yes, it is uncomfortable, but nobody said it would be easy. But it's worth it in my view. And I get the feedback that I receive even after years. So I've had skeptics. Very skeptical people. But, you know, sometimes after a couple of years, they come back and they said, I should have listened to you. Because now in my organization, it's all about design thinking or it's all about design.
Yeah, I mean, people don't like what they're not familiar with. You know, anything that we don't know, we're not accustomed
to. I totally appreciate
it. It makes sense why somebody is skeptical. I'll be honest, I myself was skeptical at the start. Not skeptical in the sense that I was going to reject it completely, but I was like, what
is this?
Gonna
work?
You know what I mean? It's new to me. I'm not, what is it? But obviously with time, I guess that is a challenge there, which makes it slightly difficult because it's arguably a cultural change. You know, people need to convince them something that they weren't necessarily taught the years of their life, whether it was in schools or in their professional careers.
Yeah.
I think one of the implementations, well, I've got 2 points on this. I think one of the reasons why maybe design thinking and prototyping in general has become, say, more popular and more in demand because of the digital age that we're in now and how these companies are competing and they're constantly iterating and customers are so easily distracted and they can so easily move to another platform, to another social media website, that if you don't keep up with the pace of change, it's over. You know, it's somebody else will beat you to it.
Yeah.
So the only way for you to survive is to actually continue to innovate. And I guess that's where prototyping goes.
I did some
work on conversion websites last year before I came to Imperial. And I think with conversions, like maybe that's a really simple example, because you can actually record the screen of somebody landing onto a page. And you can do A-B testing. So you could do things like change the color of the button from red to blue. And if you have 1,000 visitors, 500 will see the blue, 500 will see the red. And the actual answer is that people love clicking red buttons, just for the records. That's true. They're more likely to click on red buttons. And that is, I think, it's a very digital, empirical way of design thinking because you really are stepping into the shoes of the users.
That is probably design thinking to the extreme because in digital solutions, and especially if you are leveraging upon the data that you can collect, you can actually design one-to-one. Instead of doing some research and then extrapolating behavioral archetypes, you can actually design for single individuals. I know that I'm blowing your mind.
No, that makes perfect sense. Facebook, right?
Exactly.
My feed is
exactly
different to Michael's feed, and it's different to your feed because it tailors it to what I like, right? That is extreme design thinking, ultimately.
Oh, yeah.
It's got all the data,
yeah,
all about me.
Can I also say something about their project? Another very important aspect is that they decided to solve a problem that affected extreme users. So there is a tendency to solve problems for the mainstream market, you know, for the fit and the healthy and the millennials. And they decided to address an issue that is affecting a very large part of the population, you know, with aging population, of course, you know, that's a big part of the population. And that's also one of the things that I really appreciated, because those are users that are usually overlooked.
Neglected as well.
And neglected.
Yeah.
But there's actually a lot of value that can be brought. Mm.
There are a few problems I mentioned, I think, for the year 2050. Again, the global problems. One of them is an aging population.
Yeah.
One of the struggles is, what do those people do? You know, when you're 80, 90, healthcare is becoming phenomenal nowadays. What do? They work, you know? So it really is, it's a big challenge. You're tackling a really big problem. Mm.
Exactly.
Yeah. And, you know, for our solution, it wasn't make a big iPad, or it wasn't make something easier to see.
It was not an app.
It was one thing. It never even came close to an app. But we went all the way back, and we found that a lot of elderly people know about WhatsApp. They know about online banking. They know about FaceTime.
Mm.
But, you know, they don't use it very much. And one of the reasons was they just don't have internet. That was the real surprise to us, that we found people who go to What the Tech once a week to use the internet. And they'd send an email, and then they'd go home, and they wouldn't have internet for the rest of the time.
Wow.
So we started saying, so why don't you have the internet? And they're the sort of questions we started going down. And mm-hmm. there's so much complexity to get internet in your home. If you want super fast fiber, broad bandwidth, super high speeds. And for elderly people, they just want the very basic internet.
Yeah.
They don't want the fancy Wi-Fi that you can upload, download. And
the amazing thing about that is that wouldn't be the first thing that comes to mind, right? You'd think, the elderly,
exactly.
they're not using technology. Well, let's make a bigger font, bigger this, bigger.
Yeah.
But actually, the solution is so simple.
Mm-hmm. And if you try and order some internet for your house today, you'll see all the plethora of options. And it's just mind-boggling. And that's why people just say, we'll just go to What the Tech once a week.
Yeah. Even something as simple as the password, you know, usually it's on the back of the modem and it's like 16 digits long. Mm-hmm. Like, that is a big stumbling block for somebody who's a little bit older.
Yeah. To be honest, I think that's a problem in itself.
Yeah.
The amount of people, you know, you go to a friend's house or somewhere else, and it's what's the Wi-Fi password? And,
they're
looking for the modem. Usually the modem is, the router is sort of on the edge of the room.
Yeah.
And you have to go under and pull that card out, and it's a really long, complicated code. That whole user experience is just not great.
So if you're getting the internet for the first time, and you've got this alphanumeric there, it's, you know, it's not very enticing to...
Yeah, and if you're not technologically savvy...
Not only, you need glasses to read. I mean, it's more complicated than we might think.
And that was the solution at the end, the one that won the award ultimately? What did he come to at the end? What was the main conclusion?
Part of a challenge.
Yeah, so one of the solutions was this easy-to-use kind of modem. We called it like the silver egg, I think.
Hmm.
And it was basically it had an on-off button, and you just topped it up for the amount of Wi-Fi that you required. And obviously, it probably wasn't... There's room for improvement there, but it was a jumping-off point that we felt had real teeth.
Yeah, another aspect to it as well was that we were looking to get dedicated customer service for the elderly users, because Wi-Fi stops for us every so often, but we are able to deal with it. We're able to usually reset it.
Restart,
it,
yeah.
Do something, delete cookies or something. Yeah. An elderly person who's set up the internet, when it stops working, that could be it. They wouldn't, you know, it's very difficult for them to call BT or Virgin or somebody, but we would have a dedicated sort of support. And we'd also look a little bit about the user interface, so a couple of websites that they wanted to use, be that, you know, a couple of shopping websites or...
One thing that is very different culturally between somebody who grew up with the internet and somebody who didn't was the ability to troubleshoot. Troubleshooting does not exist really in the older population that we encountered. If they encounter an issue, they think they broke something and that's it. They'll put it away.
And this is something you figured out.
Yeah, this is not
something. Spending time with them.
Because I would give somebody homework to send an email and she'd come back feeling sad the next week, and she said, I couldn't do the homework because I couldn't get my Wi-Fi to work. And so, you know.
Yeah, there was a fear built in as well that, you know, when they don't understand what's gone wrong, they could make it worse. You know, if you try to click this button, we might do something worse. And it's just that unknown. So it's just easier just to, the internet didn't work yesterday, so we just left it. That's the sort of, that's some of the feedback we got anyway.
Yeah, so one of the big things that we felt like we could bring to this population was a sense of empowerment and a sense of self-reliance that they might not have otherwise.
What was the actual problem statement that you started off with?
It was,
I can't remember off the top of my head. It was basically the elderly population.
I think it was about in increasing the use of technology by the elderly population, mm-hmm. which then transformed into how can we get internet connection mm-hmm. more easily mm. for the elderly, something like that. But probably their problem statement changed so many times that, you know.
This is probably
Absolutely. Yeah.
Because as I'm listening now, I'm imagining one of the other problems that the elderly have is loneliness.
Yeah.
And you could argue that this is a solution. So if you're lonely, you know, there's so many other elderly people around the world, apart from their families,
mm-hmm.
and as a way for them to keep engaged and keep connected, well, there are websites and platforms for them to use, but they can't access those unless they have internet.
Yeah.
So giving them internet is actually a way to solve the loneliness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that one aspect that you brought up is that people were going to What the Tech mm-hmm. to hang out with other people.
Yeah.
Because they were lonely at home. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that as part of your solution, it was not just a simple modem, but it was like creating a sort of community. So it's not just providing internet, because we assume we are, you know, very, you know, friendly with technology and stuff. And we think that if we have internet connection and we can get access to all these platforms, then our loneliness, you know, will be solved. It doesn't work the same way for previous generations. And I actually feel lonely if I'm on my own at home interacting with people on websites. I like the human connection.
Real life, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah.
That is great. I mean, that's how it should be. But we are moving into new times now and everything's online. We've got kids now that are glued to their...
Yeah.
But actually, you know, I mean, we were... The business school was working with IDEO on a project about the future of... education and the future generations of students, actually, they will crave that face-to-face interaction, that human connection. So it seems like we are going back to the past somehow, which is very reassuring, because I think we are on a very dangerous path.
Yeah,
I mean, technology is great, it's amazing, but it's creating a lot of isolation, a lot of loneliness, a lot of alienation, mental health issues.
Yeah.
And so it's really about creating that human-to-human interaction. Sorry, I'm jumping from one thing to the other, but they were really great in eliciting the emotional aspects. Because when you identify emotions are a huge signal of what is working and what is not working in an experience. So they were able to identify that there was sadness, they were able to identify that there was a lack of confidence, and that was amazing.
Yeah, like there was one man I worked with who came 1 week, and he actually didn't have any technology issues that he needed solved.
Mm.
He just came there because it provided him with that human support, and you know, we got to see his friends. So I sat with him and I said, well, you know, and he's like, he was almost trying to find issues because...
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and, you know, there was another woman I talked to who mentioned to me that she was thinking about getting an au pair. Even though she was very self-sufficient, she got to the community center fine, but it was just about having someone there that she could talk to.
Yep.
So while these people didn't say outright to us, like, I'm lonely at home, like, I'm here just to talk to people, that's the sense we got from...
And the insights.
Yeah.
No, that is amazing. But to go back to your point about us going back to the norm of how things were, you know, I think one to go back to the design aspect and the UX, you've got very dopamine-focused design nowadays. It's about how can we keep Ileana engaged. I mean, the metrics the social media sites use now is how much time you spend. That's quite the metric, how engaged you are, how many hours do you spend a day on the platform. And if they can increase that, then they're succeeding. And they are essentially cheating because they are taking advantage of human dopamine. So Netflix, when you watch episode number 3, as soon as it finishes, you've got a 10-second timer. That is playing on your dopamine.
Yeah.
YouTube, I mean, even Facebook videos endorsed it now. And I find this myself, I'm victim to this.
You just keep going.
It shows me really good videos. I'm like, oh, this is excellent.
Oh, wow, that's great.
These are excellent videos. It knows me very well, you know? And I find I wasted half an hour that I could have done something else since. So, yeah, it's I don't know how this applies, really, in terms of the thinking approach.
I mean, this is something we talked about, too. It's a little bit off on a tangent, but, like, people... Well, like me personally, I want digital detox. Like I feel like I'm on my phone too much. So I'm here I hate being on Facebook so much, like blah, blah, blah. And then I'm talking about bringing technology to old people. So it's like, ugh.
Wow. Well, Dr. Ileana Siliani, I think design thinking, it's a great conversation right now. And I think you really championed it right now. You know, you've introduced it. Was it in 2016? When did you first bring it here to Imperial?
So we started with the full-time MBA students as a core module in 2015, if I'm not mistaken.
So a core module?
As a core module.
Mm, okay.
I was already teaching some design-related topics before, but they were, A, not core or slightly different from the pure design thinking methodology. I mean, I have to say that the business school has always been at the forefront of design and design being brought into the curriculum of, you know, business schools. So I am a champion, but I've found people who have supported and helped me in doing
and as
that.
As a final question to you, why should people, I guess, care about design thinking, or why should they start to take it seriously?
Well, because it can help make a huge impact on the quality of our life. Because it's by identifying salient problems that affect people, by empathizing with them, we can actually solve problems in a way which is desirable from a human point of view, but also feasible from a technological point of view and viable from a business point of view. So it's a way, in my view, but for some bias, to really make an impact on the world and to work for a positive change. Because you can use design thinking for social innovation, you can use design thinking for so many ambiguous and complex problems, and today we experience this type of problems day in, day out. So for me, the possibilities of application of design thinking are limitless, but again, I am biased.
Fascinating. Any other final words, Michael?
Oh, I'd agree. I think you know, Liliana said there's a little bit of skepticism probably, but I think people who are fortunate to get it should embrace it, and you know, you can use it in everyday life as well. It's not massive problems you look at, it's just look at your own life and say, this could be better here, or maybe, you know, I don't cook dinner enough, that's because I don't have ingredients, so maybe I should buy ingredients, maybe I should make time for that. You just, you know, reflect, and I think it, you know, it's applicable.
It could
everywhere.
Be applied to careers as well.
Careers,
so how do you to design your career path? It's, as I said, it's limitless.
Yeah.
The sky is the limit.
Not just for work and prototyping,
exactly.
business and
organization.
No, not just for that, and just embrace it and give it a go. It's a different way of thinking. And, you know, I don't think you have anything to lose by it if you just...
No,
sort of
I think so. Actually, you have a lot to lose if you don't.
Okay, yeah. Catherine?
No, I just think it's such a huge asset. You know, Imperial prides itself on being entrepreneurial and innovative, and this course is really just, you know, the fulcrum of that. So I'm thankful that I got to participate in it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Fascinating stuff. Thanks all for coming. Michael Healy, Catherine Pelican, Dr. Ileana Siliani. It's been a fascinating conversation. Thanks a lot for listening or watching the Business Podcast at Imperial College Business School. Stay tuned. Make sure you're subscribed on YouTube, SoundCloud, and iTunes. Thanks a lot. Take care.